KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Longtime news anchor Dan Rather has interviewed every president since Dwight Eisenhower, but he says the current presidency of Donald Trump is not normal and dangerous.
There is a campaign to convince people, and I think particularly young people, oh, well, this is just the way presidencies go. That is not true.
Dan Rather joins us to discuss his take on politics today, why he thinks the free press is in danger, and his new book of essays titled What Unites Us. That's coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll be talking in this hour with veteran journalist and author Dan Rather, but first we want to get the latest on the Southern California fires with John Sepulveda, host of KQED's California Report, and he joins us from Ojai, which is being threatened by the Thomas Fire, and welcome, John.
Thanks, Michael.
The news is not good. I mean, the winds have kicked up even more, haven't they?
They have, but, you know, the news is a lot better than I thought it would be this morning. So last night around 7:30, we saw the spectacular burst of fire above the hills of Ojai. We're talking about mountains 2,000 feet in some cases, all the way down to about 500 feet. At one point, the flames were about a mile to a half mile away from many structures in Ojai. And I don't know what the story is, but however it happened, the winds did not push the flames down into the town. I have not seen a structure burned. We're still waiting for official word. So at least in Ojai, for one night, it's a good story. In fact, it reminds me a lot of the North Bay fires when it looked like Calistoga was going to burn and somehow it didn't happen. That was the story for here in Ojai tonight. But we are expecting fierce winds, you know, very, very soon.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the Santa Ana winds are reportedly gaining strength and the gusts are predicted to reach at about, 80 miles per hour. So how's this affecting overall the containment efforts?
Well, containment is really slow, and we should, you know, make it really clear to the listeners. Containment just means that the firefighters can walk away from that area and go fight it somewhere else. It doesn't actually mean that the fire has stopped in that particular area. So considering that, it's a really low containment of about 5% at this time. Again, though, you know, it could have been a lot worse. Around 8:30, I was just looking at it thinking, my gosh, it is going to be a catastrophe, because the winds hadn't kicked up and the fire was spreading rapidly. Again, however that stopped, it stopped. The concern now, too, of course, is not just in the Ojai area or Ventura County, but we're seeing embers pick up and lift. There is a report that just came across the wire 35 minutes ago, and we were, KQED was able to confirm it about 10 minutes ago, that Malibu is on fire. Parts of Malibu, I should say, are on fire in a brush fire. I don't know what the acreage is. I don't know how large it is or how much of any of it's contained or whether any structure is burned. What I do know is that there's been a heavy fire presence dispatched to that area. Again, much more populated, like what we saw the other day in Los Angeles proper on the west side. So it's not so much that the winds are just causing the problems, you know, in the localized area where the 96,000 acres are burning. It's that these embers carry, and will it go into Orange County, San Diego County, deeper into San Bernardino? That's the concern of fire officials who are you know, worn pretty thin.
Then is there any more information from fire officials about the cause of the fire?
No, but what we do know, interestingly enough, is that SDG&E and Edison shut off some power grids. And so clearly there is a concern of electrical wires causing more problems or causing sparks that will be carried as they're knocked over by these high winds. So it's interesting to note that because, as you know, Michael, you know, that is one of the big suspicions about how the fire started in the North Bay. And it's something that has been followed really closely because how are people going to watch for fires on electrical grids has been a big problem. A lot of the water pumps in Ventura County, for example, run on electricity. So if you cut the electricity to try and stop the fire, if a fire does start somewhere else, you have to cut the, you have to restart the electricity, which can be a problem. So.
But when you mention about the embers carrying and so forth, there are still many neighborhoods that are really quite in danger, aren't there?
That's one way to look at it. After the night I had, Michael, I'm going to look at it the other way. Today, Ojai has not burned.
Well, because of Ojai, look at the cup half full as best we can. But can you give us the latest figures before we say goodbye on evacuation numbers and where people affected can get the most update information?
Yes. 96,000 acres in the Thomas Fire. We had about 12,600 acres in the fire that's in the San Fernando Valley, which is a good containment, about 5% containment there. We're over 100,000 evacuees, but I can't get a straight number from officials. There does seem to be some confusion. What I can say is that Ojai and the surrounding towns are all under some type of evacuation order. I would say about a quarter to a half of Ojai is under a mandatory evacuation order. So that's about half of 7,500 people. Again, that's not a lot compared to the total number which have been told to evacuate, but it is significant. We're hoping that at a later press conference, we're going to get much better numbers. And then finally, the fire that was burning near the Getty Museum in Los Angeles on the west side really appears to have been fought. I was speaking to the NPR bureau chief for the West Coast, Jason DeRose, earlier this morning, and he was saying that they didn't see any fire and as much smoke as they did yesterday. So definitely not that apocalyptic hellscape that's been making its rounds on social media. It seems to be much clearer in that area.
John, appreciate again very much the work you're doing and for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
John Sepulveda, host of KQED's The California Report. Well, for decades, the work of former longtime CBS anchor Dan Rather was a staple of TV news. Now, at the age of 86, he has been reflecting and thinking about what he's learned covering elections and wars and about the principles this country was founded upon. In a collection of essays, actually, I believe there are 16 essays, and they're quite original. In a book that's titled What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism, and we're going to talk about that book in this hour. And we're also going to talk about a number of things in the political news, including, well, the fact that Senator Al Franken's announcement today that he will be resigning in the coming weeks due to sexual harassment allegations. I also talked to Dan Rather about why he believes the American news media is facing a state of crisis, quote, as he says, greater than I've ever seen in my lifetime. And welcome, Dan Rather.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Delighted to have you here, and I guess the place to begin is your reaction to this news. I mean, you're writing for more than 25 million Facebook followers. This is a career you hadn't anticipated, and it's been extraordinary. So you're really up on the news and commenting on the news on a constant basis. Your thoughts about Franken's resignation?
Well, I'm not surprised, given the fact that after the initial what was revealed and the accusations, then it was just sort of drip after that. My own opinion clearly labels he could have survived the first two or three. But when others started coming and women Democratic representatives began speaking out, I'm not surprised he resigned. It's a very interesting time, to say the least, and because we're facing, we're going through, Michael, a title change. I was a little slow to come around to this. But with this series of recent revelations, I think that it's a day of reckoning is here. And going forward, things are going to be different. That doesn't mean that sexual harassment in the workplace and other places is going to stop. I do think that the overall public attitude has changed enough that enough men will have to start thinking and thinking seriously about what they do and how they do it. What concerns me, having said that, I do think it's a title change, a day of reckoning. It may take a very long time to reach down to the lower levels of the socioeconomic scale, the woman who's waiting tables at the diner, the woman who is helping clean the hotel rooms. People, these cases, the Franken case being, you know, with high-profile people, getting a lot of publicity, I think that will affect the attitudes in corporate boardrooms, network newsrooms, workplaces, in a lot of spots. But as I say, I'm worried that we are not paying enough attention to how vulnerable women are, particularly working women, at the lower levels of the society.
Quite in agreement with you, although I must say Amy Goodman just this morning gave a great deal of attention to that, talking to women who are organizing against sexual harassment in places like hotel rooms and restaurants and so forth. And they're out there. I mean, there's definitely a kind of a sea change there as well. How much it'll carry, we have to wait and see. But I wonder about your reflection from your own years in broadcasting. I mean, recently there was a big flap over a book about 60 Minutes, for example, and you were at CBS for many years. Richard Zoglin had started writing a book and had been zoning in on this very topic that we're talking about, and then it was taken over by Jeff Fager, who was essentially the head of news operation, and by most people's lights, much more, shall we say, gentle on this topic.
Well, no question that Jeff Fager, whom I know well, worked with him for many years, is now the executive producer of 60 Minutes. And I have no inside knowledge of what happened with the book, but I gather from the reporting that that's exactly what happened, that 60 Minutes is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. They wanted to do a 50th anniversary book. And as sometimes, I would say, oft times happens with such projects, they took on a very experienced writer and reporter to do it, and he was doing his job. And among the things that he was delving into, he was going to do a, let's face it, he was going to do a Valentine of a book. But he had his own reputation and he was a person of integrity and got to looking into what the reality of the workplace was at 60 Minutes. And he was finding some things. I don't know that there was anything explosive. But nonetheless, the executive producer of the program decided, you know what, this is not such a good idea to have an outsider poking into this kind of thing, so he took the book over himself. I don't say that in any way being critical. If I had been in Jeff Fager's place, I might have done the same thing. Who knows? But look, 60 Minutes wasn't, in my judgment, probably not any worse, but not much of any better than other places during the late 1960s when it was formed, through the 1970s when it was really the mid-70s when 60 Minutes, as we now know it, became the most popular news program in the country. And all through the 70s and 80s, I think, in fact, I can say that what was going on in most workplaces in the country was reflected in the CBS news as a whole and within 60 Minutes, which is to say, women were not given the same opportunities as men were given, and women were frequently in a vulnerable position. Now, I have no personal knowledge of anything approaching the kind of sexual harassment stories that we're hearing now from other places, but was it an environment in which some men would put their hands where they shouldn't put them?
Well, there are stories about Mike Wallace swatting women on the rear, which is what what Al Franken had problems with. I mean, they're parallel in some ways.
That's true. I knew Mike Wallace well. I worked in 60 Minutes a long time. I never witnessed that. I'm not saying it didn't happen. Frankly, I spent most of my time on the road in faraway places with strange-sounding names. And if that happened with the late Mike Wallace, I never saw that happen. But I want to make very clear that what was acceptable, what was, quote, just the way it is for women, through the 60s, 70s, into the 80s and 90s, there was some of that in 60 Minutes. There was some of that at CBS News as a whole.
It was that Charlie Rose just being Charlie, as his executive producer, who was a woman, said when some of these complaints were lodged.
Well, let's see clearly that what Charlie Rose did, and he, as I understand it, he hasn't denied it, at least not fully, is unacceptable. And let's see it clearly. It's unacceptable for a superior who has been told by a woman this kind of thing is going on, for the superior to say that's just Charlie being Charlie. I want to make clear, I have a lot of respect for Charlie Rose as a professional. But we shouldn't dance around. This should not have happened. It's unacceptable, and it's got to stop.
Talking to Dan Rather, and Dan Rather has a new book out, which we will talk about, What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. He's also president of something, and CEO. News and Guts is the name of that organization, and former anchor of CBS Evening News for 24 years, from 1981 to 2005. You've made some strong statements about the news now, and certainly there's a great deal of concern about journalism operating under the Trump administration, about freedom of the press, about the news being called the enemy by this presidential administration. Some of that went on when you were covering Nixon, of course, but we've never seen anything like this before.
No, we haven't, and that's one reason I, among the many subjects I deal with in What Unites Us, these reflections on patriotism, this is an important time. It's an important time for journalists and journalism, but more to the point, it's an important time for the country, because there is an effort to convince the American people that this is normal, that what we're seeing with the Trump administration, including his own personal relentless and continuous attacks on the press, on individual reporters, on individual journalistic institutions, and in the whole idea of a probing watchdog press. This is unprecedented. True, during the Nixon administration, President Nixon didn't like the press, and he tried to institute some systems that designed to intimidate the press and to get sweetheart coverage for himself. But even President Nixon never said the kinds of things that President Trump himself is saying, and certainly never said anything approaching it, but he also didn't do it on as consistent a basis. We have to see clearly that while I say this is a problem for journalists and journalism, and there is an effort to say, well, you expect journalists to complain about this because we're calling them out on their mistakes. We certainly make mistakes. I've made mine. You can't practice journalism and be perfect. But the reason I say we need to see this clearly, that we know, and we've known since seventh grade civics class, that a free and independent, fiercely independent when necessary press is the red beating heart of freedom and democracy. And if you don't have that as a watchdog on power, then you aren't going to have the kind of country that we have. And using such phrases as, you mentioned it before, President Trump has called the press, media, enemy of the people. This phrase and phrases like it has a resonance in history which is not very pleasant. This is the way authoritarian regimes begin. I'm not saying that we have at the moment a thoroughly authoritarian regime, but we do have in the president a president with authoritarian leanings. And these relentless attacks on the press, the public needs to care about it. Whether you're a Trump supporter or a Trump hater or something in between, this counts. This matters for the country.
It's also an attack that's been going on in this administration, though, of intelligence agencies. There's talk now of setting up with Oliver North and others a separate autonomous intelligence agency. There's attacks against the judiciary. I mean, you know, it certainly is very sobering. And like you say, it's a kind of title change there, too, in addition to what we've been talking about. But let me zone in on something just for a moment with you, because you said you've made mistakes. And there's a author named Kevin Williamson who did a piece in the National Review. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but I'm being a good journalist here and bringing it up for you to at least.
Is this fairly recent?
Fairly recent, yeah.
I don't think I've seen it.
Well, he talks about the when you ran into some problems of your own by talking about Bush's service or not service with some documents that didn't exist, and you came under a great deal of fire, partisanship, and so forth. And what he points out is, and I think it's rather harsh, my own opinion, but I'd like your response to it. He says Dan Rather, in that instance, was giving out fake news, and he's responsible in many ways and ought to be held responsible for what we see ourselves facing now and all that the president is bringing in the way of indictments against the president.
Well, I do want to point out, I haven't seen the article, but what you've just described is untrue, and it's demonstrably untrue. What we reported about President Bush, the story was correct. The story was, one, a young George W. Bush got in a so-called champagne unit of the Air National Guard through his father's influence in order to avoid going to Vietnam. That's true. That's a fact. That's, you know, this whole business of accusing people of fake news really has to do with saying, well, there are no facts, but fact one.
I thought there were alternate facts, according to Kellyanne Conway. Sorry.
But what did that story? You know, it's been a long time ago, but I'm happy to have a chance to respond to this, because this is the kind of unsubstantiated allegations that those who support President Trump and supported President Bush through the years have tried to perpetrate. So what did we report? Our story was, one, that a young George W. Bush got in the special unit of the National Guard through his father's influence, and two, that after he got in and did fairly well for a little while, he disappeared for more than a year. Now, anybody who knows the service, even a National Guard unit, you don't just disappear for a year. So that basically was our story, that he got in through his father's influence. After a little while, he disappeared, completely disappeared, and then eventually got out early. That was our story. That could not be disputed. Those were facts. Those who didn't like the story and found it inconvenient, in order to attack us, they said, well, where is the weak point? And they attacked the process by which we got to the truth. We got to the truth. Our story was true. We were attacked for the process. They centered on the documents. And by the way, nobody has proved that the documents were not as they were purported to be. I acknowledge those who say we didn't do enough to prove that the documents were so. But to this day, the Wall Street Journal, among others, will say, well, the documents were false. That is not true, which is to say nobody has proven that they were false. But let's don't belabor the point here, that this is a classic case of our story was true. We faced a successful attack to change the subject from the truth of the story, the core truth of the story, to, well, they made mistakes while they were in the process of doing the story. But as I say, it's been a long time ago, but it is germane to today because here's a case that, what, 12 years after the fact, they're still saying, well, it was, quote, fake news. No, the story was true. The process by which we got to the truth, we didn't do it perfectly, and we acknowledged it, and it cost me my job at CBS News. But as things turned out, frankly, it probably was one of the best things that happened to me.
Talking again with Dan Rather, has had quite a career as and has a new career at this octogenarian stage of his life. We're coming up on a break, and I do want to talk about your book, but could you say something about your response to the president putting the capital of Israel, of Israel in Jerusalem now, and essentially making the American embassy be the first embassy to be in Jerusalem as the capital of Jerusalem? Because you did a lot of reporting from the Middle East.
Well, I have, and I also took a trip with my eldest grandson to Israel last year. Well, in answer to your question, one, no one should be surprised at Donald Trump doing this. First of all, it is something he said during the campaign he was going to do.
It's a promise, yeah.
Yes. Second, this has been proposed by many previous candidates, Democratic and Republican, during campaigns, but none actually did it. And it is true that for all intents and purposes, the Israelis see Jerusalem as their capital, and they have long wanted us to do what Donald Trump is doing. Number three on my list is, in one way looking at it, it's smart politics for Donald Trump.
Hold number three, because we're coming up on a break. You hear the music, and that means... Let me give out a toll-free number. If you'd like to join us with Dan Rather, you can do that now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. It's 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Dan Rather. His new book is called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. And he's president and CEO of News and Guts and former anchor for CBS Evening News for many years. You were talking about we got to number three in terms of your response to the decision by President Trump to move forward on U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem.
Well, I'm saying that this is seen from his point of view. This is smart politics on his part, because a large part of his base, which includes evangelical Christians, many of them, will applaud this. And, of course, it will be well received by at least a large portion, if not a majority portion, of those Americans of Jewish heritage. So I know a lot of people who detest Donald Trump don't want to hear it, but he's on at least a mini role here the last few days. He did get his tax plan, a tax plan, through the Senate. It's an abomination. There's no other reasonable way to describe it. But
I'm glad you said his tax plan, too, because when he was talking to his fellow GOP legislators, he said, I will not veto this tax plan. Well, he's the head of the GOP. It's got his name on it. It's kind of a strange irony that I just wanted to make.
It is irony. But he got that through, and he did made this announcement about Israel. There is another side to this.
And the stock market is going up.
And the stock market is going up. And in the end, I'm glad you raised that point, Michael, because in traveling around, I find a lot of people who, not all of them Democrats, but who just sort of assume that Donald Trump may not finish his first term. And if he does, he certainly wouldn't have a second term. Well, you know, overnight's a long time in politics. A week is forever, and we're talking about what may happen in the future. But in the end, with most political offices, but particularly the presidency, people vote their pocketbooks. And if the stock market continues to go up and the economy continues to ride along at least reasonably well, Donald Trump is going to be very tough to get out of office, ballot box or otherwise. I know that's a truth. A lot of people don't like to hear that.
A lot of people are banking on Bob Mueller to perhaps compel him to leave bring an impeachment.
That could happen. But on that point, I would suggest that those who are pulling for that to happen keep in mind that certainly it depends on what evidence that Mueller has and how serious it is. But it's hard for me right now on what we know and sort of where we see Mueller going, that a Republican House of Representatives is going to be very reluctant to vote articles of impeachment on a Republican president. When the House voted impeachment for Bill Clinton, it was a Republican House of Representatives. When impeachment was talked about with Richard Nixon, a Republican president, it was a Democratic House. Here you have a Republican president and a Republican House. And unless the House of Representatives changes with the vote in 2018, which could happen, but right now it's odds against, I think it's way premature to be saying, well, what Mueller has is almost assuredly going to get Donald Trump out of office. Way too early to speculate that way.
Well, now we're talking about Donald Trump, and it really leads to your book, because you're trying to essentially put forward what unites us as opposed to what divides us. I mean, that's really the heart of your book. And yet, when we talk about the Trump supporters as opposed to those who are antipathetic toward Trump and so forth, there is a great divide. And in fact, there are many people who look at Trump supporters, many of them, and you make a difference between patriotism and nationalism, which I think is very important in your book, but many of them patriotic or consider themselves patriotic Americans, not to be labeled deplorables as they were by Hillary Rodham Clinton. So you get into the sense of just our divisions and our fractures being so great, even within the two major political parties.
Yes, the fractures are wide and deep, and we have many divisions. It's one reason I wanted to do the book, What Unites Us. First of all, I began thinking, what is patriotism in the second decade of the 21st century? What is patriotism? And then it led to, well, are we so divided that we're literally coming apart at the seams? I don't think so. I think the things that unite us, what unites us, basic things, such as right to vote, equal justice under the law as an ideal, audacity, empathy, all of these are chapters in the book, What Unites Us. What
unites our values, you're saying, American values, really.
American values.
Yeah.
What unites us is far stronger than what divides us. There is an effort, and the effort has had some success, to exploit our divisions. That's a great deal of what President Trump is about. It's a great deal of what other political forces on the national about, is to convince us, look, that we need to retire into some kind of extreme nationalism. Nationalism overlaps patriotism in some ways, but is quite a bit different in this sense. And when I say reflections on patriotism in the book, this is part of what I'm talking about. Patriotism, true patriotism, includes humility, which is to say you love your country, willing to die for the country, but also you want the country to ever be striving to be better, to acknowledge that we have our weaknesses, to acknowledge we've made our mistakes and are still making some. That's patriotism. Nationalism, patriotism includes humility. Nationalism is much more a matter of conceit. And nationalism, we know from our history that extreme economic nationalism in the 1920s led to the Great Depression. And Aryan nationalism, racial nationalism, led to Adolf Hitler. So we want to be very careful about following those voices who try to say, you know, nationalism is really a kind of super patriotism. No, patriotism is something wider and deeper than that, and that's reflected in the values that I try to outline in the book. Look, I have no illusions. This is a very difficult and dangerous time for us. So when I say I'm optimistic about the country, I'm an optimist by nature and by experience, it's not some Pollyannish, oh, well, things are not so bad. Things are bad. But if we hold dearest and closest to us the values that have made the country, we're going to be all right. It may be a long valley to get through, but we're going to be all right.
Well, you're very hopeful. I mean, in addition to maybe being sanguine and optimistic, hope comes across in the book, and it's certainly welcome in these times. But a good deal of your hope seems vested in the American character and in a belief in, well, as you say, the principles of citizenship that people take seriously, and you want them to take them more seriously, perhaps, than they do, I presume. That fair to say?
That's fair to say. And this is the time. You know, I find people when I travel around, there are a lot of people who are really fearful these days. There are people who are really afraid. I don't think it's too strong to say that there are a fair number of Americans who are quietly terrorized by what they fear is happening to the country and what they fear the Trump administration represents. And frequently they say, you know, what can any one person do? Well, one, you can review what the values are that made the country and have sustained us through previous times of great stress and danger, time of the Vietnam War, time of the Great Civil War in the 19th century. Even I was not alive during the Civil War, but we can use it as a time where, you know, it was desperate. But here's the thing, that I think we're in some danger of losing our way because we lose belief in ourselves. And to those people who say, what can I do? Number one, you know, I'm not preaching at anybody, but in answer to the question, when you roll out of bed in the morning, say, what can I do today to help another person? And then if you want to follow on, what can I do today to help my community? What can I do to help my country? But see clearly that if you want change at the top, the ultimate way to change is at the ballot box. So if you're so worried, organize, get active, get yourself and get other people to the polls. Because as the Washington Post recently remarked, the best revenge is served at the ballot box.
Well, let me go to our callers and our listeners, because many people want to talk with you. But before, I just really like to press you a little bit to tell that story that you tell early on in the book. It's a very poignant story about your father taking you to a precinct. And as you say, we weren't visionaries. We didn't necessarily even at the time understand the really subtleties and nuances of racial divide in the country and everything. But your father did something that really was a major lesson in your life.
Well, the time is right at the end of World War II. The place is Houston in Texas, which still had institutionalized racism, a deeply segregated society. It wasn't Mississippi or Alabama, but make no mistake about it, it was segregated. The precinct meeting it was happening at a time when nomination to the Democratic Party was tantamount to election. Precinct meeting, no person of color had ever attended a precinct meeting before. My recollection, four or five African-Americans who had served in World War II were now out of the service, came to the precinct meeting. There were a lot of rumbles and some sort of low-voiced threats. My father and I were there, and it was very clear that they were unwelcome and that there might be real trouble. The precinct chairman wanted to railroad through a slate of delegates and just said, all right, we're going to have standing votes here. So he would say, all in favor, stand, all opposed, stand. He explained that was the way the voting was going to go rather than raising hands. And my father, who was not a civil rights activist and didn't foresee himself becoming one, but did have a great sense of fairness about him, said to me, what, 14 years old at this time, maybe 13, said, when they stand, we stand, which we did. And my father put his hand on my shoulder and made me sit back down because I was not old enough to vote. But they, his sense of when they stand, we're going to stand with them, which was risky for him. And as we left that precinct meeting, I really thought fistfights might break out. They didn't. But it was a great lesson for me, particularly as time went on and I came to cover Dr. Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement in the early 60s. But that's what happened at that precinct meeting, and it did. It was a lesson that stayed with me for a lifetime.
It was a major impact on you, I know, from reading it. And just say one other thing. You probably never would have suspected, like most Texans of your time, that Lyndon Baines Johnson, a Texan, would be more responsible for movement on civil rights than probably any president up until that time. And I would even include a Kennedy in that. It's fascinating to, we could have a whole conversation about this, what's happened to the Longhorn State when you think about people like Molly Ivins and where are they? Ted Cruz now is your senator. But let's go to our callers and let's begin with Wynn. Wynn, you're on.
Thanks. With Congress being so deeply divided and with the congressmen spending most of their time doing nothing but raising funds for their reelection, do you foresee any possibility in the near term for any bipartisan activity in Congress? And if so, does your book tell us how that might happen?
Candidly and directly, I don't see any immediate or medium-term prospect of things changing in Congress. And you put your finger on why. Nobody wants to say it out loud. A lot of people would like to just duck and dodge around it. But this Congress, as with so many Congresses in recent times, by and large, and in the main, this Congress is bought and paid for by special interest money. And not only because of that, but primarily because of that, you aren't going to get any real progress on important legislation, in my opinion, other than straight along party lines. But we have to understand that how much Congress has changed in terms of money. Look, money has always moved the Congress, or at least certainly in the 20th century. But we're at the point now where, in some ways, Washington is a corrupt capital. But don't get me started on this because we talk the rest of the day about we have to do something about the fact, and it is a fact, that important legislation like this new tax bill is frequently written by lobbyists themselves, not written by the people in Congress. But to your point, what the book lays out, and what, the reason I say what unites us, we know that how things get accomplished in the country is generally along these lines. One person says to another, you and I disagree about 100 things, so why would you discuss that? Where is there one thing, or maybe two, where we can reach common ground and do something for the country? So often in Congress now, in fact, it happens nearly all the time, it's party before country. We have to find a way, and I'm not preaching to anybody in What Unites Us, the book. What I'm suggesting is we have a conversation about how we get back to that spirit.
Talking about getting back to a one-on-one kind of humanity, aren't you?
Exactly, and putting the country first.
Let me thank the caller. We're going to get as many of your calls on as we can, though. A listener on Twitter wants to know your thoughts on White House coverage, quote, in light of this administration's flexibility with the truth.
Well, it's more difficult to cover this administration because the administration has attempted and in some ways been successful to move the country into a post-truth political era, an era in which, well, the truth doesn't matter. Never mind, don't remind me the president said something 3 or 4 weeks ago. You know, truth is fungible, and facts are also fungible. But, you know,
I was just thinking Obama was supposed to be post-racial, now we're post-truth.
Yes, exactly. And so it is difficult with the press. But I'm encouraged that since President Trump has come into office, the American journalism as a whole has demonstrated more spine, more grit in the gut, if you like, than it had previously. Which is one reason, of course, the president is attacking it regularly.
And we'll bring you more of your calls on. Let me go next to you. Moses, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Great show, as usual. So many things to cover, but my question, and if you can please indulge me in this, and what many would probably consider to be a bit of a conspiracy theory. So while I'm, like millions of people, I'm very glad that all these sexual allegations are coming to light, and all these brave women are coming forward and addressing their situations. I am, however, just kind of curious as to how this, you know, how the whole thing started, and with Weinstein, for example, and I just wonder if there are invisible forces, so to speak, kind of working behind the scenes and not just igniting it, but also inflaming it. And I wonder if Steve Bannon would be one of those people. Again, let me just say I'm very glad all of these ugly facts are coming to light, but I'm curious as to how it's being orchestrated. I know you are a man of facts, but if you can indulge me.
Well, Moses, I think there are two questions you're raising. Yeah. One is the origin of this. I think, Dan Rather, I don't know if you agree with me, but a lot of this has to do with just the election of Donald Trump, who had 16 women come forward and make accusations against him.
I think that is a factor in what is overall in the main sort of just organic combustion. But the fact that it is a fact that these many allegations were made about President Trump, including some documented on the tape, the famous Hollywood tape, opened the door.
Which he claims now was not necessarily his voice, even though Billy Bush, who was with him, says it was definitely his voice.
Well, if you believe that was not his voice, you will believe that water runs uphill. But let's get back. The point is, to the gentleman's question, I think, was it Moses?
Moses, yeah.
Thank you for the question, Moses. One, that I do think that President Trump's ability to survive, not just to the nomination, but to the presidency, disgusted many women. I have in mind more women voted for Donald Trump than voted for Hillary Clinton, which is one reason he is president, so we want to note that. But I do think it opened the door, but I don't think it was the only thing. I do think things had reached a point where we needed a reckoning, and some brave women, and you used the phrase, and I agree with it, came forward and began calling attention. So it isn't just what happened to Donald Trump, but that was a contributing factor.
Let me go to some more of our callers, and we thank Moses for his call and go right away to a caller by the name of Shashina. Shashina, good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning, Mike. And it's great to have a person who has served our presidents for so many years. I like the comment that he made about his humility that our country needs. And also, one of the poems, men may come and men may go, but our country will go forever. The question I had was...
I'm sorry, it sounds like there's a lot of noise in the background.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask was does he think that Donald Trump will drag us into World War III?
Yeah, it's an important question. Dan Rather, your thoughts about Donald Trump maybe dragging us in a war, particularly with the rather harsh rhetoric directed against a man he calls Rocket Man?
Well, candidly, that's a danger. That I worry... And this is not something that is reflected in the book, What Unites Us, but I do worry that we are closer to a war in Korea than most people, I think, acknowledge. It's surprising to me that Donald Trump uses such inflammatory language and with a situation that's so combustible. I know the theory. I do not subscribe to this theory. There is a theory among Trump supporters, well, he's using this as a negotiating ploy. This is the reason he's a great deal maker. As I see it, frankly, rubbish. This is dangerous. But we're very close, and I just find most people don't face up to it. If there is a war in Korea, then my grandsons and yours are going to be pressed into service. It isn't going to be a war just fought by our all-volunteer force.
Unless there's so much nuclear annihilation that nobody can be pressed into service.
Well,
that's a real danger too, isn't it?
It is a real danger. In the nuclear age, it definitely is a real danger. But with President Trump, one of the worrisome things to me is that he's not a reader. And we know he doesn't, so, well, he's virtually said he seldom, if ever, reads a book. He asks for briefing papers that are short briefing papers. And I'd like to think that, using Korea as an example, that his rhetoric is at a certain level because he doesn't fully understand what the danger is.
Or because he's intemperate, which was what was said all along. In fact, I've got a kind of dovetailing comment here, get your response to it, from Judy, who says, can it be credibly argued that President Trump's responses to North Korea, as well as taking an action that intensifies Israeli-Palestinian tensions, is a means for manufacturing crises that he, as a demagogue, can then defend the nation against?
Well, every citizen, I think, needs to consider that very seriously. This much we know. President Trump has rather consistently done two things in order to always change the subject. Anytime there's a development about Special Counsel Mueller's investigation, you will notice the president says he will attack the press, or he will say something about the North Korean leader.
Or Hillary Clinton.
Or Hillary Clinton. This is the classic diversionary tactic to try to change the subject. I'm convinced that President Trump is very fearful. He's almost terrorized about something. I don't know what it is, but something he is afraid is going to be found out. And this used to be called in American political slang, wag the dog, which is to say, if you get in trouble in political office, then quickly find some danger overseas to start talking about, and if necessary, even start a conflict. I'm not saying we're at the wag the dog phase, but it is something to keep in mind when the president tries to change the subject.
Also, when we mentioned the Access Hollywood tape and his contention that maybe it wasn't his voice, or talking about so many people more at the inauguration than at the inauguration of Barack Obama, these things sound...
Which was not true.
Of course it was not, yeah. And there are these statements that are just so alternate to any kind of factual assessment or any kind of data that we have, demonstrable data that's incontrovertible, that you have to ask yourself, and I think people do, is there something maybe about the president that's off the rails? I mean, there's a whole book we featured it here about Warning to the Republic. Robert Lifton and a lot of eminent psychiatrists saying, they even gave a new name for it. They call it malignant solipsism, which I don't think is in the psychiatric books. But they were trying to say there's real danger and peril to the republic here.
Well,
somebody may be
I've
delusional.
I've heard those voices, and one cannot rule it out. But where I am as a personal opinion and journalistic. That may be, but we don't know that to be the case. I've tried, particularly in later years, not to judge the motives of people or to delve too deeply into trying to psychoanalyze them, but to make not a judgment on their motives or their mental state, but a judgment on their actions and their words. And by his acts and his words, President Trump has led to this kind of thinking and these kinds of suspicions. He has only himself to blame for that.
Let's bring on another caller. Let me go next to Timothy. Timothy, join us. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, Mr. Rather. The person who seems to want to hide something is that person in Texas called H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush. He calls himself David Copperfield. He likes to grab female butts. So that person there, you had the best interview I've ever seen in my life, trying to nail him down and him trying to evade your interviewing skill. It was masterful. But how do you square that, Dan Rather, with the Dan Rather that went to Afghanistan wrapped in rags that some detractors of yours called the Gunga Dan?
Well, as the football coaches say, you are what your record is. And both of those things are in my record, yes. I led a CBS News 60 Minutes camera crew. We walked into Afghanistan very shortly after the Russians invaded it in late 1979 and early 1980. We walked in, and to some people's amazement, we walked out alive. That's when I was working at 60 Minutes. Later, when George H.W. Bush was vice president and running for president, I had a contentious because he made it so, interview about untruths involving him and the Iran-Contra scandal. Now, much later, and including a recent book, a biography of H.W. Bush, he was not telling the truth. But your question is, how do I reconcile those things? Look, I'm a lifetime reporter. It's the only thing I ever dreamed of doing. And for a reporter, you try to go where the news is. In early 1980, the news was in Afghanistan, and that's the reason I took the risk and let a crew in. By the mid-1980s, when I was anchor of the CBS Evening News, my job was frequently to interview political office holders, and that's what took me to H.W. Bush. But for anybody who says, well, you know, how did Dan, do you reconcile all these things, including some mistakes you made? I come back to, folks, one is what one's record is.
Well, your record is stellar, and not only as an extraordinary reporter, but you were the man who succeeded for the most trusted man in America and became that figure for many years. Thank you for being with us. Appreciate the time.
Michael, thank you very much.
And Dan Rather's book, and by the way, you can learn about some of his interviewing techniques by reading his book, because there's a whole history of pugilism boxing in that book that I didn't know about. It's called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Stay tuned. We're going to talk with Swanee Hunt, and then we're going to talk about Jerusalem up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.